I want to give you permission this morning to daydream a little bit during the sermon. Now, I know you're already thinking, thanks, Jared, we didn't really need your permission. We do just fine on our own. But really, because what I hope happens this morning is that as I talk about metamorphosis, change, how God brings newness into our lives, I really don't want you focused on what I'm saying. I want you sort of daydreaming, thinking, wandering a little bit over the terrain of your own life, thinking about your own experience, and I just want you to ask yourself, where have been those rich periods in my life when lots of change was happening? Where were those significant pivot points that sent me in a new direction? Now, some of those are, of course, were things that were kind of thrust upon us that just happened to us. We didn't have much choice. Sometimes those changes were things we wanted to happen. We sort of took responsibility for heading in a new direction. But I want you to sort of be thinking about your life changes, and I want you to see whether you can find in those rich moments of new directions and new possibilities the Spirit of God at work in your life to sort of coordinate you and head you in a new life-giving direction. The Bible is not shy in suggesting that people like us really can change. We can change, and not just in little ways. We can be fundamentally reformed, realigned, and redirected to new and very different goals. This is exciting stuff. Exclamation point stuff. Before he became the person that we know as the Apostle Paul, you know this story, right? Paul was Saul, a rabid, intensely self-righteous Jew whose whole life was dedicated to identifying and then arresting and imprisoning followers of Jesus. But then the risen Christ appeared to him on his way down to Damascus, and this powerful experience changed Saul into Paul. Only one letter of difference in his name, of course, but a whole world of difference in his life story and where he headed next. Now, I told you I was going to talk about John Wayne. I generally speaking do not watch old movies, and I'm not all that big a fan of Westerns. And I'm admitting to you that even before last week, I didn't know that John Wayne was his stage name and that, you know, he has a real name. Everybody get his real name? Marion Morrison. He went by Duke Morrison, so Duke Morrison was his given name. I saw some of you condescendingly look at me like, Jared, you're an idiot. I can't believe you didn't know that. I came across a review of the 1956 John Wayne movie, The Searchers. How many of you have seen The Searchers? Anybody? Okay, several of you. This review suggested that this was a powerful story about metamorphosis and change, transformation. John Wayne plays a character named Ethan, a Confederate soldier from the Civil War who's making his way back to his brother's farm in Texas. The Comanche tribe active in that area raided his brother's farm, killed his brother and his sister-in-law, killed two of their children, and his 16-year-old niece was taken captive, played by a charming Natalie Wood. And the rest of the movie then unfolds as a revenge story with this character, Ethan, setting off in search of his niece to get her back. Now, in stories about cowboys and Indians, the white cowboys, of course, are always the heroes, and the dark-skinned, as they were called, Indians, are always the savages, the monstrous, violent ones, and that's true of this Western as well. But on this quest for revenge against the savage Comanches, something even worse happens along the way. In his 10 long years of searching for his niece, Ethan slowly realizes that if she's alive at all, she has surely by this time been assimilated by the Comanches and become one of them. And so the love for his niece that motivated his search and rescue effort turns into something like disgust for her as one of the Comanches. And he comes up with a plan to murder her when he finds her. Now, I already told you that this is a story about transformation. So you're already ahead of me. You know that he won't murder her when he finds her, but he tries to at first. But then something shifts in him. The hate loosens. Something breaks free. And he's able to do something different. And the final scene in that movie has become famous for fans of Westerns. It's a scene where his niece leaps into his arms and the character Ethan says, "Let's go home." Now, I said I'm not a huge fan of Westerns. Neither am I a huge fan of movie musicals. But on a long flight recently, I finally got around to watching The Greatest Showman because I'd heard from so many of you what a great movie it is that I absolutely have to see it. The Greatest Showman is a sort of biopic about the life of P.T. Barnum, played by Hugh Jackman. Now, I understand that it's not a very accurate depiction of the actual life of P.T. Barnum, but as a movie, I have to say it's pretty fun, all the singing notwithstanding. The movie presents a wide range of characters. There's Barnum, sort of the dreaming Barnum, and his lovely wife, his wife's rich parents, who are very mean, the show's manager that comes on and helps him to success, the New York theater critic who hates the show and hates Barnum, the opera singer who falls in love with P.T. Barnum, and all the different eccentric people who star in Barnum's show of oddities. The bearded lady, the little person, the Siamese twins, the acrobats, and lots of others besides. And although all these characters in the movie are very different from one another, they're all capable of movement and change. They can learn, they can shift, they can grow. They leave behind old patterns when they come to fresh insights about what they want, about what matters in life. Now, the movie's a little bit idealistic, of course. It's a little too feel-good. In life, in real life, it's never the case that everyone all around us is always changing for the better, right? Always discovering something new and moving on to something good and beautiful. That doesn't happen. And the soundtrack's quite wonderful. We'll hear a bit of it on our dismissal this morning. And I personally would love to have a soundtrack accompanying the dramatic twists and turns of my own life, but life never feels like that either. But what I did like about the movie is that it holds out the possibility that our lives really can move in new directions. You're not stuck. We're not stuck. Do you believe that? Our Isaiah reading today is magnificent. It's otherworldly, it's bizarre, it's alien. It names an experience open to all of us, but rarely do we access it. It's a genuine encounter with something holy. Now, I want to just pause for a few minutes. Keep thinking about your own life, these shifting points where you moved in new directions. But I want you to notice a few things about the way this experience is recorded for our benefit, okay? God will always meet us where we are. In our own specific time and place. You don't need to be someone else. You don't need to live somewhere else or in some other time. God will meet us where we are. Our passage begins in the year that King Uzziah died. It's a very specific time and place. And so God will meet us amidst all the specific markers that we can name. In the year I turned 21. In the year when I got married or got divorced. In the year I lost my job, in the year I found out I had cancer, in the year my first child was born, in the year I lost my spouse, in the year Trump was elected, in the year the stock market plunged. On Memorial Weekend in 2018, on a sunny summer day, when I heard at First Presbyterian Church in Fort Scott, when I heard the words of the prophet Isaiah, through the reading and the praying and the singing and the laughing and the conversation at church that day, the Holy God met me and changed my life. Isaiah's vision of God on a throne is a vision of almost indescribable immensity. God was so much more profoundly kingly than any regular old earthly kings and political rules. Isaiah says the whole temple was entirely filled by the mere hem of God's robe. That temple, holy and sacred as it is, cannot begin to contain the magnitude of this God's holiness. There's much else going on. God happens to be surrounded by a choir made of beastly angelic figures. They have bodies different from any other creatures you've ever seen because they are designed for praise. They are built to sing for all eternity of God's worthiness to receive honor. And so in beautiful song, if in beastly body, they sing to one another all day long. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of God's glory. The temple walls shook, and the sanctuary filled with smoke. This experience of God's holiness was so overwhelming, so excessive, that Isaiah realizes that he's out of his league. He's too small to be there. His life simply isn't substantial enough. Woe is me, he says, I am lost, for I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips. He just can't find the words to fit the immensity of this occasion. He's having an experience of something he can't quite describe. His lips can't even give voice to what's going on. Then one of these bizarre monster-like creatures, just, I'm putting it this way, just so the next time you see a little ceramic angel, you'll think, I don't think so, right? So one of these bizarre monster-like creatures flies toward him with tongs and a burning coal and touched it to his mouth. Oh, this is a gruesome image, both terrible and terrifying and wonderful all at the same time. And the angel speaks, you are forgiven. And your sin is gone. But at the very same time, Isaiah hears God's voice mixing with the angel's voice in a kind of strange harmony. Just as the angel is pronouncing Isaiah forgiven, God's voice is speaking, asking a question. Whom shall I send to do my work? Who will go? Isaiah has been transformed by an experience with the Holy God. He's dramatically forgiven, but it's clear that this forgiveness is a kind of dying to the life he knew and a setting out for new territory. We're always forgiven and called to a new adventure at the same time. Transformation will always come to us both as amazing grace and a summons to get going. Transformation happens, and it feels to us both like cool water on our parched tongue and like orders to report to boot camp all at once. Here am I. Send me. Now, in our reading from Romans, the Apostle Paul describes as best he can the radical newness of our lives as a result of God's wonderful, overwhelming grace towards us. The main pair of contrasting terms here is flesh versus spirit. Our New International Version, which we use today, does its best to avoid those terms. Paul is not talking about your body is something bad with all of its desires, right? And the soul or spirit is something godly and good. That's not at all the distinction he's making. Rather, Paul's trying to form a contrast between your whole human life either turned away from God's goodness and light or turned towards it. Now notice that Paul has taken the death and resurrection story that happened to Jesus, and he's using it to describe patterns in your life and my life. So dying and rising is something that we share with Christ, and the new life that Paul describes is a life that's always emerging from death. What dies is our old way of life, our old habits and patterns, our old values and commitments. So according to Paul, death and resurrection are a pattern that you can notice in your own life story. When God's Spirit connects us to the life of Jesus Christ, and by the way, that just is the good news, right? If you ever, somebody says, what's the good news? Just say, God's Spirit has connected all of us to Jesus Christ. When that happens, we come to share in his reality, our own lives, participate in his dying and rising. So if you ask, what will this new risen life of Christ look like? What will it feel like for me, for us? Well, Paul gives us some other images and metaphors. He says, it will not feel like you're a low-level employee in a large organization. Okay? You're not a slave, says Paul. It will feel more like you're a beloved child, adopted and warmly welcomed into a new family. And God's Spirit in your life will mean that your basic motivation in life, what drives you when you get up every morning, will not be fear. You won't be afraid when this happens to you. You won't be afraid of God. You won't be afraid of not being loved. You won't be afraid of not being good enough. And you won't be afraid of failing or of making mistakes. Lives motivated by fear are characteristics of employees and slaves. And that's not you. Your children adopted into a new family by loving parents, and you don't live by fear anymore. We live with a new kind of confidence. We can now sigh, breathe a little bit, and relax into a new kind of life where God is always nearby, always available, always present to us like an affectionate, reliable parent. That's a different way of living. Now, as God's adopted children, God's Spirit begins to change us and rearrange us, to form us and transform us. And over time, the patterns that marked Jesus' life, his dying and his rising, his tenderness, his mercy, his empathy for the poor and for those who are hurting or in trouble, all those patterns begin to press themselves upon our lives. God's Spirit slowly starts to mold us into this new form. That's why Paul can say that as beloved children, we are not to expect a life of ease or wealth or success or comfort. We are expect a life that looks like the one Jesus lived. A mixed bag of laughter and heartache, joy and suffering, celebration and grief. I heard a story about a friendship between two unlikely people on a college campus. Derek Black grew up in a racist family, not just a family that was a little bit racist, okay? His father was a leading figure in the white nationalist movement. His father, in fact, gets credit for building the first website devoted to hate. So Derek was raised in this racist family. He was the heir apparent of a leading white nationalist family. David Duke, the KKK member, was his godfather. Okay. When Derek Black went to college, he went to New College in Florida, and he met another student there named Matthew Stevenson. Matthew happened to be one of the very few Orthodox Jews on that campus. And here's how their strange friendship began. Someone on campus did some research. They had heard of Derek Black and his family, and they outed him. They identified him as being a white nationalist. When Matthew, the Orthodox Jew, found this out, he decided, now let me ask you, is this what you would do, right? He decided to invite Derek to a Friday night Shabbat dinner he was hosting in his dorm room. And surprisingly, Derek accepted the invitation, and he started going to Friday night Sabbath dinners in Matthew's dorm room, and he went for every Friday night for 2 years. The journalist and podcast host Krista Tippett spoke with both these friends, Derek and Matthew, at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. That's how I heard this conversation. By the way, if you don't catch the irony of the conversation happening at the Holocaust Museum, white nationalists deny that the Holocaust ever happened. They say it's fake news and a hoax. So Derek Black attended those Friday night Sabbath dinners for 2 years, and for the most part, no one asked him about his family, about his racist views, or about white supremacy. They did their best to get to know Derek as a person, as a human being, and as a friend. And he got to know the others, and not all of them were Jewish, but some of them were. So he was raised his whole life to hate all different kinds of people, but especially Jewish people. And here he was sharing Sabbath dinners with other Jews for a period of 2 years. And these other folks developed a real friendship with Derek, even though they weren't clear what he thought. There was no evidence that he was changing. He didn't say anything about he was giving up his views. They just let him be. But slowly, over the course of that 2 years, as their friendships developed, Derek would once in a while take walks with one friend or another in the group, and he would ask them about their lives, and they would share about that, and they would ask him about his life. And the more he got to know the others, the more confused he became. Slowly, he began to wonder why his own family's devotion to whiteness required so much hatred towards Jews and towards African Americans. Growing up, he was taught that it had this way of life had nothing to do with hate, his parents said. It was only about standing up for the superiority of white people and the need for white people to stick together. But in conversations with these new friends, he began to see how dangerous and how hurtful his views were for other people. And it didn't happen immediately, and it didn't happen all at once. But the result of those friendships over the course of 2 years was that Derek decided eventually that he could no longer belong to a white nationalist community and left his family and left that way of life. Now, when our lives become hard and rigid, there's very little chance for newness. Change always requires some softness, some flexibility, some modesty. If you live your life in a defensive mode, always arguing, always justifying who you are and what you've done, it's almost impossible to move off in new directions. If you can't apologize, if you can't express regret, if you can't take responsibility for the times you failed to love or failed to be kind, you put yourself in a kind of straitjacket where there's no room for movement. Friends, in our politics and in our conversations about cultural values, we are right now experiencing a crisis that stems from this very inability to express remorse and a willingness to change and move in new directions. On a wide range of issues, from our country's troubling record with Native Americans and with slaves, to our treatment of immigrants and children, to the ways we respond to peaceful protests against injustice, to the ongoing terrible saga of men treating women badly, we have a chance to admit what's gone wrong and our role in it, to open ourselves to a new day, to leave behind our harmful habits and take up practices of truth-telling, honesty, modesty, and kindness. These will be enormous changes, but they are not impossible. And it can begin today, right now, here with you and with me. Here we are, Lord. Send us.